America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. But with some of the headlines that you just see today, I mean, headlines about record murder rates across the country. And here's one: parents wise up about critical race theory. And then the latest headlines about COVID and the people who believe that it's part of a gigantic conspiracy. What does it all have in common? Well, part of what so much of the news has in common is a bias for the bizarre, a bias for news that is bad, that shows conflict, that is alarming. And all of this has an impact. And Kevin Smith, who teaches political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, has actually done groundbreaking and very important work about just how badly politics can make you sick. And it's not just the people who are political junkies. It's the politics that is in the air that is unavoidable today. Kevin Smith studies the biology and psychology of individual-level differences in political attitudes and behavior. He has authored or co-authored 10 books. He has his PhD from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and he is the co-director of the University of Nebraska Political Physiology Lab. Dr. Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invite. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're happy. Americans have been going through all kinds of what people talk about as deaths of despair, drug overdoses, suicides, depression measurably up. And your basic recognition is that politics does have something to do with it. Explain.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've done the same survey three times with two different samples and gotten pretty consistent results that, you know, people look at politics and see it as a, you know, taking a pretty negative toll on their emotional, psychological, social, and even physical health. You know, most people seem to, or huge numbers of Americans seem to see politics as this thing that is kind of like a chronic source of stress in their lives, and it's not having great effects on them.
And by the way, is there a notable difference in terms of partisan alignment? Do Republicans get more distressed or upset about politics now that there's a Democratic president, or were people, including Republicans, fairly upset during the Trump era as well?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We actually don't have the data that sort of like goes too far into the Biden presidency, but the data that we do have that was primarily collected under the Trump presidency indicates that people who are more on the political left, like Democratic identifiers, tend to report suffering these effects to a greater extent compared to people on the political right or Republicans.
And what about different, you just have information from your surveys on, in terms of your, reaction to specific political figures. I saw the New York Times in the piece Michelle Goldberg did about your studies. She says the mental health toll of Trump era politics. Is there reason to believe that the Trump era, which a lot of people think we are still living in, that the Trump era was rougher on people's mental health than prior eras in American politics?
Yeah, that might be a reasonable hypothesis, Michael, although the only honest answer to that is I just haven't got the data to, you know, give you a really firm empirical answer. I mean, one of the things that I can say is one of the things that motivated these studies is, you know, there started to be these bits and pieces of evidence coming out from different places that suggested that politics was becoming an increasingly, or an increasing source of stress for Americans even before the Trump era. you know, for example, Chapman University does this a semi-regular survey that looks at what Americans are most afraid of or what causes them the most fear. And I think it goes back to 2014 or 2015, where Americans were indicating that politics was one of the things that they increasingly had fear about. And I think that's just sort of like, you know, reflects this kind of worry and stress about politics that has been kind of like endemic and in the air for a while. But it's, I mean, I think it's certainly a reasonable hypothesis. There's no secret that during President Trump's administration, it was a pretty divided and polarized time that continues today. And if it didn't make things worse, I'm pretty confident it didn't get any better during that time period.
In terms of, would you relate this, and I think you do, or must, to some of the popularity of conspiracy theories of various kinds? I mean, when you have 15% of Americans, at least according to some fairly authoritative surveys, who believe in at least part of the QAnon theory of a cabal of blood-drinking, Satan-worshipping child molesters running the world, that would be pretty politically upsetting.
Yeah, I'm not sure, though, whether that is a cause or a symptom of sort of like this larger environment that isn't particularly good for Americans' mental health. And, you know, and some of that is definitely emanating from, you know, sort of like this polarized political environment that we're in, but is the, you know, people believing in QAnon conspiracies, is that causing other people to be stressed, or are people stressed and that makes them more vulnerable to these kind of conspiracy theory sorts of things? You know, that's something that we haven't been able to fully disentangle yet.
Have you taken a look at the possibility or the incidence, which must be there, of some people who have found deliverance in politics, where they end up getting involved as activists somehow, and suddenly they look and it's morning in America. They feel better because of their political involvement.
Yeah, that's, well, we've looked sort of like tangentially at that. I mean, one of the things that, you know, some of the studies that we've done have looked at cortisol, which is, you know, commonly known as the stress hormone. Your body releases cortisol as it gets stressed out. And one of the studies that we looked at people's baseline levels of cortisol, and people with very low levels of cortisol, with lower baseline levels of cortisol, tend to be more politically interested and engaged and seek out engagement with politics. And one of the things that we wondered there is whether people who are low cortisol are just looking for stimulation. You know, they actually enjoy the social conflict that inevitably comes with stepping into the political arena.
Well, and again, we had this record turnout. We had the highest presidential vote turnout since 1908 in 2020. Is your sense that that this would also help to explain the sort of addiction to the steady stream of news and stress, why this particular pandemic got put in such a intensely political context?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that's a reasonable perspective on things. Again, though, I'm not sure that the data I have can speak directly to it. I mean, one of the things that I can say is, you know, the findings that we have, I don't think are tied to the pandemic, because we did the initial survey in 2017, which, so that was, you know, so that was pre-pandemic.
Can you hang on for a few minutes more, Dr. Smith?
Oh, absolutely.
Good. We will be right back with Dr. Smith of University of Nebraska-Lincoln, Kevin Smith, with more on stress, politics, and mental health. On the Michael Medved Show, the findings of Dr. Kevin Smith at University of Nebraska are just stunning. They can knock you out when you take a look at it. 40% of Americans identify politics as a significant source of stress. Additionally, between a fifth and a third of adults, in other words, between 50 million to 85 million people, blame politics for causing fatigue, feelings of anger, loss of temper, and triggering compulsive behavior. And about a quarter of adults report that they'd given serious consideration to moving, relocating because of politics. Now, with all this going on, is there some kind of growing effort that you could see or discern, Dr. Smith, with people trying to isolate themselves or insulate themselves from some of these negative impacts of being closely involved with politics?
I think even if you try to make those efforts, Michael, it's hard to pull off. I mean, politics is so pervasive, it's almost impossible to avoid, even if you're making the effort. I mean, most of us wander around these days with a supercomputer in our pocket. And, you know, for a lot of people, especially young people, it's dinging every 30 seconds with some algorithmically determined, you know, attention distraction. And a lot of that has to do with politics these days.
Okay, let me ask you two different questions that are very clearly related. I mean, one of the things that I think of is that one of the most successful campaigns in American history, talking about politics, was an entirely gauzy, pastel colors, lovely, uplifting, cheerful campaign called It's Morning in America. It was Reagan's reelection campaign. He carried 49 out of 50 states with that campaign. Why? With so many clever politicians looking for an angle, why do you think that people have not hit on this idea of more upbeat, uplifting, less horrifying kinds of political appeals?
I think probably the short answer to that is negative emotions provide more motivation to behave and are a greater driver of attitudes. You know, if you resent something or if you're angry at something, you're more likely to take action than if you're happy. I mean, you do raise a really good point, though. I mean, following the Reagan campaigns, it was kind of like this article of faith that Americans are fundamentally optimistic, and appealing to that, you know, can get you a pretty broad political base and get them motivated out to support a candidate. I think what we've seen, I mean, if you'll remember kind of like what happened after the Reagan era, you know, you've got the rise of like Lee Atwater, you know, driving campaigns, that sort of era. You know, if you want to motivate your base, you sort of like demonize the opposite side, and those negative emotions, there's no doubt about it, they're very motivating.
Well, and again, particularly if you want people to contribute money, you basically can appeal to fear.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a very powerful appeal. That will get people to bring out their checkbooks, and it'll motivate people to get down to the voting booth and cast a ballot.
But then again, you talk about Barack Obama and the way that he won two different elections decisively. And his slogan initially, remember, was one word, hope.
Yeah. Hope, yes.
And to which, by the way, a lot of Republicans would say nope, but that was then. In terms of individuals who may be at least resonating a little bit with what we're talking about, and the fear and the conspiracism and the negativity and the sense we've just deluged with all of these articles and observations saying we're on the verge of civil war. Can America even exist? If people want to try to put that in a more constructive context, what would you recommend from your research for the individual participating in this great political system of ours?
Well, this isn't from my research, Michael. This is more personal. But my personal recommendation would be find somebody that you like, who you politically disagree with, and spend some time with them. And, you know, approach any political discussion with them with the principle of charity. And, you know, you might find that even though you don't end up agreeing with them politically, you might find out that you have more in common than you have differences. I mean, I think a lot of what is going on is this notion of the fear of the other side and the fear of the other. And the, you know, everyone from political elites to the man on the street is kind of like demonizing the people that they disagree with. I think, you know, one of the ways in which any individual can take a constructive act to deal with that sort of like polarized environment is just try to take some purposive action to reach out to somebody who you politically disagree with. I mean, you might be surprised. You might end up liking them.
I do remember, and we're going to go on the speaking right after you leave us. We're going to be speaking a little bit about media bias, which there's a powerful piece by an observer named Eric Weiner, who says that, look, the real political bias is a bias for bad news because it gets more eyeballs. People pay attention to it if a hurricane is coming or if there's a 8-car pileup on the freeway or a mass murderer is on the loose or if we're about to have a civil war or we have a raid on the Capitol building. That kind of thing gets people to pay attention. Right. But if a plane lands safely, if a guy comes home for dinner or a woman comes home for dinner with a family and they sit down peacefully and say grace before the sort of more normative, what used to be considered normative American ideals, that doesn't draw as much attention. Is that a factor in this a political
today
bias toward negativity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a very strong negativity bias. I mean, there's the old saying, right, is, you know, if it leads, it bleeds. Or if it bleeds, it leads.
Well, let's not bleed and let's lead, but in a positive direction. I know that's what Dr. Kevin Smith is attempting to do. We have information about his work and his books at our website at michaelmedved.com. Dr. Smith, thank you for joining us. And then, is the real political bias just a bias for bad news, or is there a deeper bias for the left? We will get to that and more coming up on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show. There's a sense in which the two different theories of media bias all actually come back to the same thing. And there's a provocative piece that appeared in gen.medium.com. And it's a piece by Eric Weiner, someone I don't know, but his work actually echoes a lot of work that I've done and pieces that I've written, and even it's contained in books that I've written. I mean, I've always said that the real media bias is a bias for bad news, that we don't have a news business anymore. We have a bad news business because there's a sense, and this goes back to Tolstoy, in the beginning of one of the most famous novels ever, Anna Karenina, which is about a what ends up being a deadly affair and a broken marriage and all kinds of difficulty. Novel begins by saying that all happy families are the same. They're happy in the same and similar manner, but every unhappy family is different in its own unique and fascinating way. And that's a quick approximation of the Russian. But the point about this is you can look at that. What rivets people's attention are things that are unusual and threatening and tragic. And this is not just your news programs, and it's not just the emphasis on bad weather and disasters and predicted civil wars and political malfunctions. It's it even goes to the world's greatest tragedies, which are Macbeth has been kind of a hit for 400 years. And that's actually also full of bad news and negativity. Eric Weiner writes, the media is biased, but not in the way you think. The critics are right, he says. The mainstream media are biased. It is not a political bias, though no liberal or conservative slant, but something even more insidious, a bad news bias. During my decades as a daily journalist at the New York Times and NPR, he writes, I knew that reporting on happy people and places wasn't going to advance my career. No one told me this. They didn't need to. The bad news bias is simply understood. If it bleeds, it leads, goes the cynical newsroom slogan. A quick scan of media sites bears this out. A ceaseless parade of disasters, human and natural, current and forecast, and all framed in the most negative light. The bad news bias is a global phenomenon, he writes, but it is most pronounced in the U.S. One study found that in their pandemic coverage, media outlets in the U.S. struck a far more negative tone than their counterparts abroad. 91% of the U.S. stories were negative versus 54% overseas. The mainstream U.S. media are even more negative in their coverage of COVID-19 than scientific journals, the study found. Now, how does this relate to the perceived liberal bias, which I think is a reality, and anyone who tries to deny it, forget it, it's there. You know it by talking to people. You know it by looking at different White House press conferences. People tend to be on the left who are in media. Now, why would that be? Because the left is obsessed with bad news. If you're on the left, you want to change things really dramatically. Have we had basically people who say they want to transform America? They want to remake America? Trump's slogan was, let's make America great again. Go back to something that we had before. But the liberal impulse is the liberal for sweeping, dramatic change. Remember at the beginning of the Biden administration, oh boy, it's going to be the new FDR. He's going to be the new LBJ. He's going to spend trillions and trillions of dollars. Basically, the idea that let's settle things down. Let's get things solid and calm. And that's not a liberal appeal. And basically, all of the heroes of liberalism are people who promise sweeping change. Now, sweeping change only becomes saleable when people have the sense that we're in the midst of some kind of crisis. We've got horrible bad news. Right now, I do believe there is such a thing as climate change. I think that we have some challenges with climate change. It's real. But again, you exaggerate that because that allows you to have even more sweeping changes than people would anticipate. And it seems to me understanding that explains a lot of things. I'll tell you a story. When I was a kid, and we're really talking about a long time ago, it's the early 80s, and I got my first regular TV job on CNN, the first year CNN was on the air. And I worked there for 3 years. And it was, and basically reviewing movies, covering movie news, also to some extent. And during that time, Ted Turner, who was running CNN, sort of like his private fiefdom at the time, he got this brilliant idea, and I thought it was a pretty good idea. Well, their news is full of bad news. Let's do a half hour a night of good news so people can just tune in who want to see good news. And they had, I think her name was Liz Witherspoon, who was a fetching, very charming correspondent who was friendly with Mr. Turner. And basically, it flopped. And she came on and she smiled a lot and she talked about good news and these rescued puppies and children who had miraculous recoveries and people who were doing good and kindness all around. And nobody wanted to watch that. And I know that I think they called it the good news, and but with no religious implications. It didn't work. And the difficulty is that, again, when it comes to fascination, people tend to look toward the negative. Now, this is one of those aspects where it really does get complicated, because you like to give some credit to people who are trying to look at hardship and difficulty and then look on the bright side. And there is this piece that appeared, and it's in Seattle'sChild.com. And they have a piece that just appeared. It says, "Want to help people living with homelessness in Seattle? Start simple." And then they have an entire series of recommendations for how you can help people who are living with homelessness in Seattle. For example, here's how Suzanne Strauss's family started an annual tradition of socks giving. They raised money from friends and family and used it to buy socks during Fred Meyer's Black Friday sales and deliver them to Facing Homelessness, Tent City 4, and people on the street. Every year, this very nice lady, Suzanne Strauss, raised more money, and several of her friends started drives of their own. She did another somewhat successful drive, buying sleeping bags from Labor Day sales. Okay, this is all very admirable, right? And clearly well-intended and meant to be good news, but did it work out that way? Well, again, if you look at the connection between homeless encampments and drug addiction and crime and destroyed lives, maybe there's some lessons to be learned in the midst of this, especially with a pretty shocking case of hostage taking in West Seattle. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show. Michael Medved Show, one of the things that can cheer you up, really it can, and talking about the bias for bad news, which is a real bias in media, talking about the sometimes negative impact on your emotional health, even physical health, of all the negativity. One of the things that is important is perspective. And when you look at how much better the world has gotten, and it really has, than it was 50 years ago, than it was 200 years ago. And just one little squib and one example of that. We were talking about this, actually, a couple of days ago. And I'm just with friends, and talking about it in synagogue, actually, that one of the things that is remarkable today is that most children grow up to adulthood. And as recently as 1920, nearly half of all American children didn't survive childhood. It was, and childhood death was incredibly common. And we don't have that today. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because it's one of the reasons that I am so proud of what we do with the MedVed History Store and what we do with our MedHead Plus subscriptions, because you have access to history, to context, to perspective that other people are not going to necessarily get. And it's going to cost you all of 22 cents a day. That's all. 22 cents a day dropped out of your pocket, you probably wouldn't notice. But you'll notice the perspective on American heroism, greatness, destiny, what people would call providence. All of that, the subject of MedVed History programs. Take a look at MedVedHistoryStore.com. That's what's on offer. That's all in your hands, free to download, to stream anytime you want, at a cost of 22 cents a day for a MedHead Plus subscription. Go to michaelmedved.com or medvedhistorystore.com. All right, this doesn't exactly make history, but it actually is related to local history. The headline says, "Deranged homeless man live tweets his second hostage-taking attempt in 6 months." And here is the way that that is reported on Cairo News.
Is also no stranger to the King County Prosecutor's Office. He's been in court multiple times for multiple felonies, and he's also been released multiple times as well. Let's start with what happened here yesterday evening at about 5:30. Police say there was a person in crisis inside this Target. Workers here tell us the man was aggressive, and they believed he had a knife. The standoff ended around 12:30 in the morning, and the man was taken to Harborview Medical Center. We're not naming him because he has not been charged for this incident by the prosecutor's office, but they tell us they will file charges as soon as they receive the case details from local law enforcement. As we mentioned, this man has been charged with several felonies before. The most recent case happened a couple of weeks ago. It was a felony assault charge that led to his release.
We've argued consistently every time that he's a danger to the community. And I think what we saw on Friday shows that. We've argued two things, that he's a danger to the community and needs to be held on bail because of that, and also that this is somebody who needs help.
Again, charges have not yet been filed for this incident. We'll keep you updated as this story develops.
Okay, still hasn't been filed on this incident. His hostage taking consisted mostly walking up to customers with a knife and telling them they were hostages. No one was hurt. And police believe the goal of the entire effort was to force the cops to shoot him, suicide by cop. After negotiations failed, SWAT was sent in, and they tased the suspect and then brought him out. In all, the store was locked down for nearly 7 hours. This is a Target in West Seattle, wasting a ton of police resources. The man's name hasn't been released. Because he hasn't been charged. But why hasn't he been charged? That seems to be the story of his life. Just 8 days prior to the incident on Friday, he was arrested for assaulting a police officer. Despite a request that he be held by the prosecutor, a judge released him to his own recognizances. There's more audio. Listen. Yeah, this actually is the according to Hot Air, he was actually tweeting, live tweeting his hostage taking, such as it was, and it sounded actual hostage taking. This is a first for our show. It actually sounded like this.
Well, this court case isn't gonna be fun, and no, I'm not representing myself. Yeah, I cannot represent myself for sh-. I got super lucky that the prosecutor's office just did bull charges on me on that one. See, my face is all messed up because I don't have money for shit, man. So this is a very unique bear cage situation that I've created. So what happened is I didn't have access to guns because of being a felon, not having money and connections to buy up the street, would not be able to assemble a ghost gun if had the money to purchase the components and the 3D printer and whatever. So this is, so we have, in the criminal element, there's nobody even that comes even close to the understanding of tactical and negotiation, and having worked for a law enforcement agency, this is a very unique.
Okay, yes, he needs help. His previous hostage-taking attempt, which was August 18th of this year just passed, the suspect attempted the same type of hostage situation at the Fred Meyer in Burien. And he armed himself with a pair of scissors and said he was looking for the kitchen area of the store. Once he found knives in the kitchen area of the store, he armed himself with one of the knives. According to a police department document, he explained his intention was to take hostages in the store. He requested that SWAT and crisis negotiators respond to the scene. He claimed to have taken his mother hostage recently, but was now taking Fred Meyer hostage because he could not get the help he needed by just taking his mom. As the store was being evacuated, the suspect negotiated with officers. Finally, he was taken into custody with no injuries and charged with felony harassment, but the prosecutor dismissed the charge, and it appeared to have been downgraded to a misdemeanor. Okay, he has 11 different... This is unbelievable. He has 11 different experiences where he was doing attempted suicide by cop. And this is one more. Do we have one more, Jeremy? Okay. The suicides by cop are terribly sad. But I think actually listening to this individual, you're not going to solve his problems by bringing him socks or a sleeping bag. And the difficulty with this very nice article about what we should do for the homeless people, helping people needn't take a lot of time or energy, they write. There are lots of ways that busy people can still make an impact. And Rex Holbein, founder of Facing Homelessness, says many people don't know where to start when it comes to taking action to help people who live outdoors. One of the big stumbling blocks is not that we're not compassionate people, but that we're really overwhelmed by it. Yes, that's true. Facing Homelessness is a campaign to fight that in the simplest way possible by encouraging people to make eye contact and give a kind word to people they see living on the street. The point of the Just Say Hello campaign is to get people in the habit of thinking about those around them and to break the habit of looking away. Holbein says that homeless people often feel shunned by society, and small kindnesses can do a lot to make their days easier and brighter. And there are other benefits. See, the problem is, it's not a good idea to make homeless people feel comfortable for living the way that the individual in these so-called hostage takings happen to be. And the idea that basically you should feel obliged to make people feel more comfortable when they are camping in a park near your home, or maybe a school that your child attends. This is not the answer. To smile at despair, not a solution in this greatest nation on God's green earth.